With the eye of a stockman born and raised, Jim appraised the booty as he rode among the captured herds. These were tough, hardy animals with massive shoulder humps and a wide rack of horns. They were tame and trusting and showed no alarm as Jim rode within arm's length. All were in prime condition, glossy hides and rumps bulging with fat. At this first inspection, Jim saw no evidence of the maggot-infested wounds of screwworm or the wall eyes of fly-borne ophthalmia, but he did notice with satisfaction the healed scars of sweat sickness on the glands of the throat, which proclaimed their immunity from further infection. For them to have survived in such fine condition, he was sure they must also be salted against the disease of the tsetse fly. "These are more valuable than any cattle brought from Europe," he told Louisa. "They have immunity to the diseases of Africa, and have been lovingly raised by the Nguni. As Tegwani told us, they love their cattle more than their own children." Zama had left the band of horsemen and disappeared into the encampment of thatched huts. Suddenly he rode back, his face working with agitation. He was speechless with excitement, and gesticulated for Jim to follow him. He led Jim to a stockade of freshly hewn tree trunks. They lifted the logs out of the gateway, and Jim went through, then stopped to stare in wonder. Before him lay Manatassi's treasure house. The ivory was piled in stacks as high as a man could reach. The tusks had been graded by length and thickness. The immature ivory, some of which was no thicker than a human wrist, had been bound with strips of bark rope into fascines, each making up a load that an ox could carry comfortably. The larger tusks were also bound with bark rope so that they could be secured to a pack saddle for transportation. Some of the tusks were huge, but Jim saw none to match the pair he had taken from his own great bull. While Small Boy and the other driver unsaddled the horses and took them down to the river to drink, Jim and Louisa wandered around the ivory storeroom. She watched his face as he gloated on this mass of treasure. "He's like a little boy at Christmas time," she thought, as he came back to her and took her hand. "Louisa Leuven," he said with solemn formality, "I am at last a rich man." "Yes," she tried to wipe the smile from her lips, "I concede that you are, but despite all your wealth you are really quite a lovable lad." "I am pleased you've noticed that. That being agreed between us, will you marry me and share my riches and my abundant charms?" The laughter died on her lips. "Oh, Jim," she whispered. And then the strain of the battle and the pursuit of the impis caught up with her, and she began to weep. Her tears cut runnels through the gun soot and dust that coated her cheeks. "Oh, yes, Jim, I can think of nothing that would please me better than to become your wife." He caught her up and hugged her. "Then this is the happiest day of my life," he bussed her heartily. "Now dry your tears, Hedgehog. I'm sure we'll find a priest somewhere. If not this year, then next." With Louisa held in the crook of one arm, and his other hand laid possessively on one of the stacks of ivory, he looked over his newly acquired herds, which filled half of the valley with their abundance. Slowly his expression changed, as he was struck by the age-old dilemma of the rich man. "How, in the name of Satan himself, do we keep our hands on what we have won, for every man and beast in Africa will be eager to take it from us," he wondered.